and one of the rocket-propelled grenades. So what it does is it sends a piece of copper, which turns into a molten slug pellet about probably about 4 inches long, 2 inches wide, something like that. And it travels through the air at 200 miles a second. One of these penetrated guy's vehicle at an insecure spot or whatever, a weakness, went straight through the vehicle, straight through guy's right leg, taking it off below the knee, and then embedded itself in the chest of 19-year-old Private Robbie Laws, who was the ECM man, killing him instantly. I remember I met up with Guy again recently, and he was saying that, you know, it's just mayhem. And he said, I looked out, I was trying to work out what's going on, and I didn't know Robbie had been killed, but there are people lying around, and I looked down, my leg was sort of hanging off, and then I lost control, and what happened then is a troop sergeant took over. So I'm not aware of this at the time, but I'm aware that a troop sergeant has taken over, because I'm now talking to him and we're talking about how we need to extract these casualties, where we're going to extract them from, how we're going to get to them, what is the best plan. But Guy recently said, he said, what was really annoying is when they tried to get me out of the vehicle, my leg got jammed somewhere and they were ripping the bit of the left. I still had a bit of, it was still connected slightly, and they were pulling it off. Like, stop. Not quite stop, but you know. My memory's not great over this period. Talking to Owen Candy, the forward air controller, need helicopters in. So there was a request for helicopters. Then a 20 minutes later or whatever it is, I hear the distinct waka 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 sound of the Chinook helicopter. Look over to my right. It's accompanied by two Apache attack helicopters, which was so grateful. They were such an asset out there. When you knew you had an Apache, you felt really safe because they could see so far ahead and do so much damage to the enemy that were trying to kill you. So that added security straight away. Called to my company sergeant major. He threw a smoke grenade. Orange smoke goes up, disappears as a Chinook helicopter banks round. The tail ramp is down. There's a gunner on it. We've secured the area. We've moved around, and the casualties are being dealt with to the left. And I'm at this stage, okay, I can't be distracted by that. I need to be focused on what we're going to do next once the helicopter's gone, because we are way behind now. We need to be clearing 3 kilometers, and it's nearly the end of the day, and we've only gone 400 meters. And so I then watch the first body being taken on, the first stretcher, and I can't see Guy's face because the distance is about 200 meters, or 100, whatever it is, 100 meters, no, it's Leah. But I know it's Guy because there's this ragged shape of a leg that's hanging off the side of the stretcher. Behind them are some walking wounded, and then I didn't know it was Robbie Laws at this time who was killed. I knew a soldier had. I was aware of the ZAP number, which is the identification of the individual who's the casualty. And then watched a stretcher with a sheet over it and feeling, what was I feeling? I know I felt really, really sad, really sad. And I also remember thinking that, shit, in a few hours' time, there'll be someone in a suit and tie, a casualty visiting officer, who will be knocking on someone's door, telling them that soldier, you know, as I said, I didn't know it was Robbie, that Robbie has just been killed. And I thought, shit, I'm... Jeez, I'm sorry.
It's all right, mate.
I haven't reacted like this for a...
It's all right. Just take your time.
Still recording, sorry.
Yeah, it's alright, we'll edit all that.
No, you, I mean, keep it, I mean that genuinely, because if people are to understand, I'm not ashamed of crying anymore. I'm not ashamed of showing my feelings. That was completely unexpected. I've never cried once in probably 8 years discussing that, and I don't know where that came from.
It's a, it's a, when we're on mics, when there's two of us on mics, yeah. It can evoke a lot of emotion. It's a weird situation when you're really focusing just on the voice and the actual story instead of everything else. You know, when we chatted yesterday in the art gallery, and there's distraction, and go through automation. But when you're actually reliving it, it's really powerful, and it does evoke
bloody hell. Okay. So I was thinking of someone who would be knocking on someone's door, and then the helicopter flying away.
At the beginning, it was very difficult because it was obvious the guys were a secret. You know, you would hear about those that had been killed, but you didn't hear about the injured, even though obviously I knew 30, 40, 50 a week were coming in. There was nowhere that was public knowledge at that time.
Is that right? Is that what was coming in?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you just thought, well, I thought, if they're a secret, I have to be a secret in order to do what I do. So I didn't want to do anything that would jeopardise, you know, the ability to go in and just bring this little cheer to the guys.
That's what you mean, yeah.
Some people say, well, one of the boys actually said to me, you shot yourself in the foot there, Kath. And I laughed. I said, well, maybe I did. But I know every penny I've raised has been raised with love and used with love. And you can't beat that. That's the essential thing. It's not about having a huge bank balance. It's about showing compassion and love for a fellow person in distress. And a lot of the guys will actually say that to you. One of the guys said to me recently, he said, you turned up at my darkest moment when life didn't seem worth living, and you managed to bring light, love and laughter back into my life. I will never forget that.
I'm feeling that the cake is the inn.
I think it is.
And then beyond that, there's counselling and guidance and love.
I don't think I counsel. Well, I don't. I don't counsel.
Not formally. Not a formal counsel, but more of encouragement and guidance.
Well, exactly. And, you know, they used to love a hug as well. And that used to be quite comical because there were two distinct types of hug. Although, actually, I've learnt there's three now, but the one we won't discuss. So the first one was like a rugby tackle. And they would just mangle you. And no words were necessary. You could feel they were saying, thank you for being there for me. Thank you. You know, and some of them would say, I don't know how to thank you, but they didn't need to. And then there was one where they would just put the head on your shoulder and sob brokenheartedly. Mm. And I'd just hold them. I didn't need to ask anything, didn't need to know anything. You know, you knew they were having a bad day. And then you would feel this sigh and this release. And then we'd just crack on.
We stood by a green, small prayer garden, gorgeous. Like if you can imagine, so short you could putt on it. And it was just the greenest thing I've ever seen in Afghanistan. And we were eating biscuits. And we asked the sun if he would lead us across to the next compound, because we were kind of boxing around. Can you lead us a safe way across the fields? And he said, yes. So we followed him, and we got over there, and he freaked out. He just flipped out and legged it. And so everybody knew something was wrong. So all the valens came out, all the metal detectors came out. Everybody was looking around. We found a room that had some supplies that looked like they'd been used to make a bomb. We were like, this is, you know, this is bad news bears. And then somebody stepped on a low metal content legacy IED. It's low metal content because they'd use as little metal as possible, so we couldn't pick it up. Legacy, they say that it had been dug in there 8 months. So that bomb had been waiting for us for 8 months. And it was big enough that it blew the first guy apart. He died. The boss was the next closest person and had a large part of his, a lot of big injuries to his head. And he didn't survive. The interpreter had taken cardboard out of his body armor because he thought it was too heavy. Not cardboard, his body armor out, and replaced it with cardboard because he thought the body armor was too heavy and he thought nobody would notice. So he took a phenomenal amount of shrapnel to his thoracic cavity and actually to his abdomen.
Chest.
Yeah, his chest. Yeah, sorry, his chest and his abdomen and his stomach. And unfortunately, it shredded up his stomach so much that he died of sepsis later in the hospital, which is not a very pleasant way to go, because you're sent, your own shit's pretty much poisoning your body. And then myself and JJ survived. I lost my leg below the knee on the right side. I nearly lost the left one. I've got some nerve damage on my left leg. I'm missing a chunk on my right. I had double fracture of my pelvis, including an open book fracture and the fracture of my right acetabulum. And then I had a semi-detached retina in my left eye, a mild traumatic brain injury, and I now have type 1 diabetes as a result. And JJ had a phenomenal amount of damage to his hands, his arms, his face. Yeah, we were pretty chewed up.
Can you just tell me a little bit about Sam Alexander?
Yeah, Sam stepped on the bomb. So he lost all four limbs and bled to death. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry to the family, because I know sometimes when things are brought up on social media, sometimes Sam's sister can get sad about it. Even it's 8 years down the line, and I still get sad about it. I can imagine what the sister feels like. So when I say he had all four limbs blown off, I know that sounds like a really blunt thing to say. She knows what happens, and I just hope she's not listening.
You've taken that one step further. You're now researching your PhD in amputee biomechanics. Why did you choose that? What's the reason?
So my academic journey has sort of been going on. That's my leg. I've been going on the whole way from point of injury, really. So I guess before I went to Afghanistan, I was naive to prosthetics. We've been taking a lot of casualties at this point. So you'd seen footage. I'd had friends who'd come back who were diffy a couple of legs and were then put onto these prosthetic systems. But naively, I thought, this is the 21st century. It's a bolt-on replacement for the leg you've just lost. You know, we've got... Your Terminator's been out for decades. Like, we're in the 21st century. We've got Bluetooth. We've got microprocessors. We've got AI. We've got all this stuff. So I just assumed that the prosthetics you put on would be robot legs, and they would be everything you needed them to be and more. So when I first started wearing prosthetics in Headley Court, and you realise just how deficient they are compared to biological legs, the legs which I'd left in Afghanistan, like, it just wasn't acceptable to me. So coming into that viewpoint as a mechanical engineer, like, you always know that if you want something done, you have to do it yourself. Like, no one's going to do anything for you. You might have to steer people or whatever, but if you really want a problem solving, unless you're prepared to solve it yourself, it's just not going to get solved. So I figured maybe I can just apply my unique set of experiences, coming from the military and the project management and the planning kind of stuff that entails, and my background in mechanical engineering, and now my experiences as an amputee, and just see if we can't go and make these legs a little bit better. And there's this underlying feeling as well that, as far as the government is concerned, they do not have a good track record of looking after troops in the long term, and I can't help but shake the feeling that, we're currently well looked after. We currently have a budget for the provision of the best available prosthetics, but going into the future, is that budget always going to be there, or are they going to turn around in 5 years' time and be like, well, we've got no budget left to provide these prosthetics for you, so you're just going to have to go on a peg leg and be happy with that, and that's what you've got. That's your lot. I just can't help but shake. I can't shake that feeling that we're going to get screwed over at some point and not be provided for. So at least if I can make top grade prosthetics, then I know that me and my mates are squared away in the long term. Because these things aren't great. But hopefully, we can start to make a difference in this field. And by looking at amputation not as something that is treated with just with prosthetics, but something that is treated with optimization of surgery, optimization of rehab, optimization of the clinical side of prosthetics, and optimization of the technical equipment that goes on the outside. Like, I genuinely think we can make a huge functional difference to our amputee population, and that's what my PhD is all about. It's about changing things and making sure that, not that I can run faster, but it's that I can carry my daughters down a set of steps or carry the shopping up from the car because my wife's pregnant. That's the important things in life, and those are the things which I can't do. So it's about getting a real life functional change, not not jumping over buildings or anything stupid. Like Iron Man would be awesome, but there's a basic step to go through first.